Welcome to the Ohana Life Podcast. I had the pleasure of speaking with my good friend Cynthia on the topic of being a good ally. There's a lot that's been going on in the world in terms of our fellow humans, those of color, and what's happening just doesn't seem fair to me, and so I'm trying to understand it better. Cynthia has been helping to take me through this journey over the past year and a half, trying to understand it. And I thought, what a great time for us to kind of chat about ways that we can help, ways that we can manage the unfairness that we see, and how yoga has helped her. She is a lawyer in the criminal justice system, and just happens to see things that are unfair and stressful in her life and how she's been able to cope with that. But more importantly, this is really about how to be a better ally to others and really use our power and our voice to be better humans. So I hope that any part of this is helpful, and maybe you know all of it already. But for me, it was a learning curve and a learning process, and I thought, why not document some of it? So I do hope that you can find some solace and some education in it, and I would love to hear what you think. Enjoy.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So this idea of podcast came about, we had joked that you would be my first official guest and we would just talk about podcasts.
Yes, I love podcasts.
Yes. We both listen to so many podcasts and we love them. And not that we pick them apart, but we're like, these are good. These aren't as informative. And we sort of had this really, you know, good discussion around that. So it didn't end up that you were my first guest, but here you are as part of a more important topic. So over the past, I would say maybe year and a half, I've been doing a lot of different trainings that have included this particular topic that we're going to talk about today. And you have helped me along the way. So you've sort of helped me discern and talk it out and understand what it is that I don't understand about it. And you've done it in such a way that you've kind of not coddled me, but sort of held me along so that I didn't lash back or I didn't feel intruded upon. And I got to make these decisions on my mind myself. So today we're going to talk about a difficult topic, racism, and what it is to be an ally. And because of everything that's been going on in the world, especially George Floyd, that kind of propelled the world into kind of learning and listening and understanding a little bit better. I thought it'd be great to have you here to help all of us just understand a little bit more about these things that we just haven't been exposed to as much here in New Hampshire. And I'm from Massachusetts. I think you're from Massachusetts too, right?
I'm from New York, but I lived in Mass for a while. Yeah.
Okay. And so I didn't have as much exposure to the injustices that happened. And so you've really had to explain that to me. So can you just tell people a little bit about yourself and maybe what you can talk about today?
Yeah. So I grew up in upstate New York in like a small town. And then I ended up going to law school. I'm a lawyer. I work for the New England Innocence Project. I'm here only in my own capacity. I'm not representing anybody, and I wouldn't presume to tell you that I'm by any means an expert. And one of the things that we've been talking about even doing this podcast was talking about how ideally you would have a person of color that would be able to come on here and talk about this. But at this point, the feedback that we're getting from everybody is that people of color are tired of educating, you know, white folks about racism, and it's time for us to educate ourselves. So my goal here is to just sort of convey some of the information that I've learned there's so much other information that exists out there. There's so much learning that I have left to do, but this is something that I have been studying for quite a while. I was a public defender in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire, and through that job, I became exposed to sort of the failings of the criminal legal system. And I feel like that has sort of provided a backdrop for me to start learning more about white privilege and about white supremacy. And, you know, we'll talk more about what those mean, I'm sure. And that's sort of where I'm coming from today. Again, please do your own research. And I've sent a lot of notes to you, Lisa, about that have books, suggestions, article suggestions, pictures, videos, just different ways to look at things and think about things, current things, and you know, the sort of underlying basic assumptions or basic tenets of learning to sort of be involved in anti-racism work.
Yeah, I mean, this is big. And when this all happened, I, like you, saw that a lot of the people of color had said, we're tired, you know, we can't be here to explain it all to you because we've been going through it for so long. So the best thing that you could do for us right now is to find a friend that is white who has done the work and talk to them and really work it out with them before you come to us. And that's what I wanted to do today, is really figure out what it is to be a good ally, Cynthia, yeah. Because I know that you can, you've helped me. I know you've helped a couple of other friends that I know. And so I think it would be good to kind of start from the beginning. So let's, I guess, explain some of the terms.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to ask me and I'll tell you, or do you want me to?
You might as well start with some of the ones that we should know. I have a list, but I'm sure you have more. Go ahead.
Well, let's just start. I want to explain a couple of things. So when I talk about racism, I think we're so caught up as a society in a binary existence of good and bad. And the problem with racism is that we've assigned this bad thing, this bad value to it. And racism, of course, is not good. But what people need to understand in order to be not defensive about white people when we're talking about race is they need to sort of separate it from that bad and good piece. This is just a piece of what the way we've been raised and the way we exist. So it's something that we need to address, but you don't need to take that in as a personal guilt. You just need to accept that, like, this is something that exists in the world. You have benefited from it as a white person. You have oppressed other people intentionally or unintentionally because of it. And we need to sort of be able to move on from there. So when I say racism, I mean, it involves, there's a difference between racism and prejudice, right? So prejudice, you can have prejudice, Black folks can have prejudice against white people can be prejudiced against Black people, there can be all different kinds of prejudice. Prejudice is sort of a negative feeling that you have about somebody that's different, that's other than you. Racism, to me, involves a component of oppression. So the reason, so when I say somebody is racist, I mean that you are engaging in a system of behaviors that oppress somebody based on race, okay? So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're intentionally doing something. It's just the existence in a system that's racist that makes you racist. So you don't even necessarily realize what you're doing. I think the word racist is so charged. And when I say it's not bad, I just mean, of course it's bad. We don't want to be racist. But my point is, when you become defensive, it's because you think you're doing something bad. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm just explaining that the system of government that we have, the criminal legal system, housing, and all different kinds of pieces of the system, healthcare, education, operate in a way that disadvantages Black people to the benefit of white people. That in itself is racism. The reason that we say Black people cannot be racist is because they cannot oppress. The reason they cannot oppress is because they are in the minority. They do not have the power to oppress. So racism naturally involves that exercise of power. And that power comes from numbers. I mean, originally, right? There's more of us white people in this country. So we oppress. And those people are in power. I mean, we continue to elect white politicians. We continue to have white people in positions of authority all the way up the chain. The majority of police officers are white. The majority of school principals are white. You know, these power hierarchies create the ability to be racist. So I think racist is sort of the first piece that you have to understand, that it's this system of oppression that's based on a power dynamic. And it's not necessarily about that you hate somebody or don't hate somebody.
Okay, so to be anti-racist, or have the term anti-racism, that is, you're against all of that.
Yes, actively. So there's a difference between being not racist and anti-racist. So not racist is, I don't use the N-word. I don't, like, I have friends of color. It's that kind of thing. Like, I you know, I'm not racist because I don't purposefully, knowingly perpetuate. To be anti-racist is to make yourself aware that these systems are in place, and then to actively fight against those systems in your life. So you are saying, not only am I, do I not hate this, you know, person because of their race, but I'm also saying I'm making a commitment to fight against the implicit racism that's part of our system of governance. And that's hard, because this is how our entire minds have been shaped and formed by the things that we've learned. You know, that, you know, you and I have sort of talked about this. You know, we grow up one way, we're educated one way, we're told certain things, and now we have to unlearn those.
So that actually makes a lot of sense to me, not racist, but anti-racist being just that step above where you're actually doing something about it. Okay.
Right.
That's very helpful. Right. So what about white privilege?
Okay. So white privilege means that it's inherently, by the color of your skin being white, you get benefits in a society that Black folks don't, or that Black folks are specifically disadvantaged in a way that white folks aren't. So usually the way that privilege is the easiest to understand is examples. I've attached in the notes a super basic article that I think everybody that's come to anti-racism work, when you start to educate yourself about this, that everybody has read, which is the Unpacking the White Privilege Backpack, the Peggy McIntosh article. And I would suggest people read that, because that's a good start. Very, very basic, super beginner stuff. But it's eye-opening. I mean, it's really, I think that's like sort of the piece about this that's so hard. There is so many things about racism that pervade so deep. But anyway, the white privilege can be the best example that's done. It's illustrated by example. So I guess I would say, for example, and this is my sort of piece of this, in the criminal legal system, there are laws made, and then there are people that are in charge of enforcing those laws, and there are people that are in charge with prosecuting the crime, and then there are people that are charged with giving sentences for the crime. On average, Black folks are arrested more, prosecuted harder, and sentenced harsher for the same crimes that white folks are prosecuted for, in smaller numbers with less stringent charges and lesser sentences. So it is a privilege to be white, even if you are a person that's getting arrested for committing a crime, because you are likely, just by the nature of your skin, just by your skin color, to receive a lighter sentence, a lesser charge, or to not be arrested in the first place. So the perfect example is the George Floyd scenario. There was a tweet by somebody that had gone around, had become viral, about how this man said, when I also tried to pass a $20 counterfeit bill. The difference between me and George Floyd is that I, a white man, when I tried to pass that $20 counterfeit bill, that's a fun story for me to tell at parties, and George Floyd lost his life. That's white privilege.
Yeah. So then what is white supremacy?
So white supremacy, so white privilege and white supremacy are related. White supremacy is essentially what we've talked about as far as there's a systemic, white supremacy is like believing and promoting that whites are better as a whole. So it's a system of dominance, essentially. So it's like, because of the power structures that we've talked about, white people end up being in these positions of authority. They continue to perpetuate these notions about white people being the superior race. So it's tied into so many different things. So the problem is that what has happened over time is that racism was, obviously during slavery, racism was very explicit. You're black, therefore you're less of a person. In fact, our Constitution used to call you property or 3/5 of a person for voting purposes when they were trying to count up the, to calculate the number of votes you would get for an area. So the reality is, for example, this is a great example because the reality is for voting purposes, you get the number of delegates you get is based on your population. So the higher your population, the more delegates you get in government, right? So you want a high population because you're going to get more people to represent you. So what they did at the time was they gave, for every black slave that was owned, you were allocated 3/5 of a person for that area. So people with heavy slave areas had very high populations and got a lot of voting power, whereas places without slavery didn't have that. The interesting thing about that, besides the fact that we're calling a person the 3/5 of a person, which is offensive in and of itself, is that, of course, the reality is black folks can't vote, couldn't vote during that time. So like, not only are you saying these people aren't people, they're property, but for the purposes of giving us, you know, for the purposes of rising our town above everybody else's town, we're giving you these votes, but none of those people can vote. So your vote carries more weight every time. Does that make sense? That every time you vote, you're getting like, if I have five, you know, if you had five slaves, you would get that 3/5 for each slave. Your vote counts that much more because they're not voting, but you are. Okay. Yeah. So white supremacy sort of maintains this system by, at the time, these were sort of explicit, right? Now we can't make things that explicit. So what has happened over time is that, laws have become implicitly biased, like I said, with the sentencing and the court process. Nobody says, I'm sentencing you to a harsher sentence because you're black. There's just an association of blackness with bad, with criminal, with scary, with danger, all of which we've been conditioned to believe.
Can you then explain what reverse racism is? Because I've seen this a lot in people trying to defend. I mean, like, I personally would never want to treat anyone less than human, ever. That's just not who I am. That's not who you are. That's not who anyone I know is. But when they get angry, which is sort of where we're at, right? So I saw it as an example of like a movie where you see the woman has been abused for years and years and years by the husband. And finally, at the end, she takes something and she just whacks them with it. And everyone's like, yay. You know, they're very excited that she finally stood up for herself. So here it is that there's all these protests and people are finally sticking up for themselves, but then there's other things happening. And so some of the terms thrown around is, but that's reverse racism. So what does that mean?
So I cannot tell you, this is what I will say. Reverse racism is not real. So that is a conception that people have that because black people, like if black people express a negative idea about white folks, it becomes this reverse racism. So people frequently say things like, we don't have a white entertainment television, or we don't have a white pride month, or we don't have a white history month, or we don't have, we don't have whites only colleges, right? So it's kind of like the reality is there is no white, all of those things are racist. To say those things is racist. And the reason is this: the system has made you feel like white is normal. So every other month besides February, which is Black History Month, you don't think of it as White History Month. You just think of it as normal. You don't put it in terms of race because you're white. So the reality is Black History Month is 1 month of 12 months a year. White people get all 12. We teach white history all the time. That's what I'm saying about racism being this dominance, this power dynamic. You have, it's created in your mind a perception that white is normal and white is true and white is base, so that when somebody says Black pride or Black history or Black anything, you think, well, that's something different. That's something other. What we should be thinking about this as Black History Month should be all the months, just like White History Month is all the months. We should be teaching those things to everybody all the time. That's the same thing with Black entertainment television. Every other channel is white folks. They're all dominated by white entertainment, white sitcoms, Friends, Big Bang Theory. It's white people doing white stuff. There's one channel for Black folks. And when we say things like, why isn't there white entertainment? There is white entertainment television. It's every other channel and every other show. And when we don't recognize, when you say reverse racism, that's the people failing to recognize they're still brainwashed. Their eyes are still closed. They are not woke, quote unquote, to the fact that that is all in our heads, that this is normal. It's not just the government. It's just the entire way society sees Blackness as other. Right? We've othered it to the point where when they say the word Black, we think, oh my gosh, it's an attack on whites. It's not an attack on whites. It's a promotion and a celebration of Black culture and Black heritage. And it's something that we should be paying attention to 12 months a year and on every channel. Why does every movie, romantic comedy, most of them involve white people falling in love? And if a Black person is part of that, then they become sort of a token Black person who assumes stereotypical attributes, or it becomes about them being Black. It's never just a story about two Black people falling in love as a romantic comedy. It always is something else. So it's this dominance that creates a perception of reverse racism that doesn't exist. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So do you think that we're just sheltered here in New Hampshire? Pretty sheltered?
I think,
from seeing the injustices?
So I think that New Hampshire is full of white people and we don't challenge each other to see these things because we don't encounter them. Or we think we don't encounter them on a regular basis, but I can tell you that that is not the case. Certainly, I was in the criminal legal system here for a long time, and I definitely know there are people that I have friends that are afraid to drive into this state, friends of color, who are afraid to drive into the state because they're afraid of getting pulled over. They're afraid of what's going to happen to them if they get pulled over. They're afraid of for their own bodies, for their children, about what happens if they get pulled over in this state. And there's reasons for that. I mean, there's stories that back that up that aren't populated, that don't populate the headlines, but they're there. And New Hampshire just doesn't put those forward because white people don't want to hear that. And the state is full of white people. I mean, I don't think we're sheltered. Sheltered would imply that it doesn't exist here and that we don't have to deal with it. It does exist here. We're choosing not to deal with it. And when we say, well, there's not a lot of Black people here, it's like, yes, that's true. Maybe we should question why that is.
So what is allyship and how to be a good ally?
Allyship is working towards an anti-racist agenda. So there are different definitions of allyship and there's different opinions about how to be a good ally. I mean, I'll just be clear about this. I mean, this is part of the discussion that we had about this podcast. It's like, should I be opening my mouth and talking about racism when I'm a white woman in New Hampshire? You know, there was a lot of back and forth about like, you know, what's the right decision and what's not the right decision. And I think allyship can look like educating your friends. Allyship can look like talking to your family that has said racist things or low-key racist things or has racist ideas that like don't see as racist, because most of us don't see ourselves as racist. I mean, I think that's like the thing about New Hampshire. When we talk about sheltering, it's like, well, I'm not racist. And you know, the one black guy in my town, I love that guy, you know? And it's like, that doesn't mean you're not, that doesn't mean that you're not racist or that you're anti-racist. It just means that you still haven't seen the system and society for what it is. So I feel like allyship can mean, I feel like allyship means good, different things to different people. To me, ally is a verb and not a noun. So you cannot call yourself an ally. You have to behave like an ally. It's like love. Love is not a noun, right? It's a verb. It's a choice. It's a behaviors. And allyship is behaviors. So it's saying, I see this and I'm going to do something about it. I recognize this law, for example, and I always come back to law because that's where I live. This law is neutral on its face. In other words, it doesn't say no black people can own cars, but I know that it has a non-neutral effect. So in other words, the impact of this law is going to be more negative for black people than for white people. I know that because people have told me that, I've listened to that, and now I'm going to vote for somebody who's not going to choose that, for example. So allyship is listening to people of color when they tell you something is wrong. Allyship is learning about the racism, the systemic racism, white privilege, white supremacy. And allyship is actively working against that. So allyship and anti-racism are really aligned. In other words, to be an ally means to make efforts to be anti-racist. So your hashtags are great and your Facebook posts are important, but there's other pieces. You got to show up. When Black people tell you they need you to show up, you need to show up.
Yeah. I mean, that was the biggest thing I've gotten out of these past couple of weeks is listen. Pause, listen, and spend the time learning the stuff that's right. Not in the history books, the stuff that people don't talk about very often. And, you know, it makes my heart so sad that anyone has ever treated that poorly and that they were treated that poorly and I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
You know, that it was just something I grew up not knowing.
Yeah. One of the links that I've shared in the notes is a YouTube video that makes me cry, and I've seen it multiple times, and it's parents talking, black folk parents talking to their black children about interactions with the police. And there is this little girl who is under 10, and her father says, you know, we practice at home what to do if the police stop her. This child is under 10 years old, and he knows that this is a real thing that could happen to her. And this is the practice that they have in police for how to stay safe. And she's, does it, says, you know, she puts her hands up. She says, my name is Ariel. I forget her last name, and I don't have a weapon and I don't have anything on me that can hurt you. So she has to say that. She has to practice that, internalize that. This is the things that black parents are teaching their children about the people that are supposed to be protecting us in this society at large, right? My parents never said anything to me about any of that stuff. One time when I was 8 years old, my dad and I had gone up, we're Irish, so we have family parties, lots of drinking. We had gone out to get like liquor and wine to bring to a birthday party. It was just my dad and I was a little kid. Got in a car accident and the bottles broke. So it smelled pretty horrifically like alcohol in the car. And when the police came to the car accident, they could smell it. I could smell it. Everyone could smell it. No one accused my father of being drunk. Nobody arrested him. Nobody pulled him out of the car. He was out of the car, but, you know, pulled him out of the car, slammed him onto a roof, took him down to the police station. There was none of that. There was no suspicion of that. I know it's a small town. People know my dad. That's great. That's fine. My dad's a white man. I don't think that's the same experience that people are going to have. One of the things that you'll see if you watch the video is these people get pulled over for their real rear tail lights being out. They're not having a bumper on their car. Minor things. Woman talks about how one time she was pulled out of the car for not having a bumper. She was arrested and her children were sitting in the car, and she was arrested and taken to the police station and her children were just sitting in the car. What for a bumper? Is that when we needed to arrest somebody, was when their bumper was broken? I mean, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, that happens all the time that we just don't, as white people, we don't see that.
There's something about this George Floyd case that just switched. It's like, in a good way, has switched people's thinking. And no matter, we don't know what it is, but at least it opened people's eyes to some of it. And again, it's just a very sad, sad topic that it's still happening to the degree that it is. And you're seeing more in the court system.
I mean, I feel like this is the George Floyd. The sad fact about George Floyd is that George Floyd isn't different. This has been happening forever. And we keep saying these people's names forever. Public lynchings go back to, you know, the Civil War, slavery times. It was happening since white people came to this country. I mean, it's not just Black folks. I mean, this country, the white piece of this country is founded on the backs of indigenous Native American people. I mean, that we've committed genocide and horrifically treated these people here. So it becomes like, it's just, this is so ingrained in their DNA. Like this is how things are going to be. And, you know, as far back as, you know, that original time of coming to America for white people has been terrible for people of color. It just, and this is just something that we don't want to acknowledge. And why would you want to acknowledge that? And it's something that we don't. And that's the great thing about George Floyd, is that hopefully now people are going to open their eyes. And that's what we're hoping, is that there's going to be a tide change, that people are going to start to realize these sorts of things and going to start to understand and going to start to put people of color in positions where they can be exacting some power and using, you know, using the power dynamics in a way that's going to be able to help it. Honestly, the power dynamics were created by white supremacy in the first place. So we have a long way to go.
We do. So can we talk about then colonialism?
Yeah.
Because that kind of ties into it as well.
Yeah. So colonialism is like sort of a concept that's related to white people sort of coming in and taking over cultures. So obviously America is founded on colonialism, and the basis of America is colonialism. You know, we came in, there was a culture here. We do things like celebrate Columbus Day as if it is the day of our, you know, origin. That is not true. There was people here before white people. Those were the original Americans. Set up our own settlements and our own areas and essentially either eradicated the cultures that were here before, took some of their practices as our own, and then threw away the other practices. We were disrespectful towards them. We forced them to assimilate to our culture more than we had assimilated to theirs. And we've treated them as savage. Is the word I don't like to use. That exists worldwide, right? I mean, another perfect example of colonialism, especially when we're talking in a yoga podcast, is like the British had colonized India as well. Colonialism comes with obviously a lot of problems because, you know, obviously you're a dominant culture and you're erasing the culture that exists before through violence, through force. And that's why it's such a problem.
And I mean, I guess we look at like by the time it gets to our generation, it happened far enough back that we don't have any real ties to it, that we just can't really associate as much, I don't think. And I think that's where the problem lies, right? Like if this had happened 10 years ago, it would be so fresh in our minds of everything that happened.
Right. Well, and people don't want to, that's very common, right? That whole narrative of, I didn't have any slaves, my family didn't have any slaves, I don't have any slaves now, this is not my fault. So the reality is that it may not be your fault that there was slavery, but it is your responsibility as a white person that benefited from the power dynamics that came from the colonialism, that came from white supremacy, that came from white privilege to fix it. You're the only people that can. There's a video that I've sent to you in the clips, and the woman in the video is a Black woman, and she makes this analogy. If you and I were playing Monopoly and you know, you were a Black person and I was a white person, and basically I wouldn't, every time you got money, I took it from you, and I wouldn't ever let you hold property or have money. And for 400 years, that's how I behaved. I took your money every single time. And then for the last 50, I let you keep your own money. But I had my own money, plus I was taking the money from you that you were earning and the property that you were earning and the property that was yours, and I was taking that as mine. And I now have all this property, and I, you know, maybe 450 years, it's not me anymore. It's my kids, right? But they now have all this property that they got because of my wrongdoing, right? So are they at fault? No. But are they responsible for reallocating that property and giving it back and making the playing field fair? Yes. And that is why at the end of the day, you know, we're in a country that's built on the backs of people of color, Chinese immigrants, African American slaves, Native Americans who helped us, all of these people. It's just, this is, and we took from them everything. And we killed them and we did all these things. Yeah, it wasn't me personally, but it's not my fault, but it's my responsibility now to correct the mistakes that were made. And so when we say, you know, it's not my fault and I didn't have any direct consciousness, and it's true, but that doesn't matter, because at this point, it's the dynamics are so skewed, we have to help reset the balance.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing that, and I did not know this, but people of color with COVID are dying at a faster rate. I did not know that. I didn't know the whole healthcare piece to it was I didn't get as much healthcare. Even as a doula, I didn't realize that because all the accounts I follow now are featuring Black women and Black births. And I didn't realize that they don't get the same type of healthcare to deliver a baby.
Yeah. Black women are like significantly more likely to die during childbirth than white, like significantly.
So how does colonialism and cultural appropriation differ?
So cultural appropriation is taking a practice or any sort of cultural aspect of a less dominant culture as your own, and sort of, there's different ways of looking at cultural appropriation, but it's where you benefit as you're the dominant culture, you benefit from taking this cultural piece, whereas, you know, that person would not benefit from it. For example, one of the things that's frequently cited about appropriation, and is a pretty easy one, is dreadlocks. So many traditionally African-American hairstyle. And what happens is Black folks are called thugs, they say they look dirty. They say they aren't, it's not good hygiene. They're considered unprofessional if they have dreadlocks. But white folks that get dreadlocks are edgy, are cool, are hippies, are, you know, there is no negative connotation, the same negative connotations as there is when Black folks have dreadlocks. So that's an example of appropriation. So you're taking something from another culture, making it your own, you benefit from it, and the other person normally does not benefit from it. Bindis are an example in the Desi culture, you know, to wear a bindi. For an Indian woman in America, people call you dothead, which is an offensive term. And they treat you negatively. Whereas if you do that as a white person, so I know a lot of pop stars were wearing bindis for a while, and it was sort of considered cool. And like, you were like this like alternative chick that's like just edgy and neat. And you don't have the same spiritual connection with that thing, with the bindi, for example, that obviously a person of Desi culture would have. So you're you know, you're appropriating, you're taking something that isn't yours and benefiting from it. And you're usually stripping the spiritual meaning or the underlying meaning, not necessarily spiritual, but the underlying meaning of that object in your use of it.
Yeah, because I know yoga here in the West can get kind of a bad rap because of this cultural appropriation and not using it correctly and putting things in your studio that maybe you don't honor or don't know the meanings of. So that can be tricky as well. I mean, I know you actually were in the teacher training and the yoga training that we had, and, you know, you helped me with this as well. It's like, look, you are looking at the lineages and you're trying to stay true to them as much as possible. And so that's all you can do.
I think cultural appropriation in yoga is so complicated. And we know we've talked about the Yoga is Dead podcast that's out there for people to listen to. And obviously they are the authorities on that kind of stuff. I think the best thing you can do is do the best you can to be honoring the lineages. But there's a lot of different opinions about appropriation. And appropriation is so hard for white people to understand, and it's so hard to incorporate all the times. Sometimes you don't even know where the things that you use and the things that you have in your house come from. You just like the way they look, and you didn't even know that it, you know, had meaning to other cultures, but it does, and then it becomes a whole issue. I think you really work hard to stick with the traditions. And I know that, you know, maybe there's, you know, maybe practice isn't always perfect for everybody. It's not perfect for anybody, right? But at the end of the day, I think the important thing is to, you taught where it came from. You had people of color teaching portions of your teacher training and involved with your teacher training, people that were from the yoga culture to doing that teacher training. And I think those are important things to make sure that you're doing, to have somebody that knows those things firsthand. That's if people want to learn, that's who they should be learning from. You know, this is the discussion we've been having this whole time.
So can we do the last term? The next term is tokenism. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So, tokenism is where you sort of, and I guess most commonly, and again, this is easier for me to explain by example. So tokenism is where you sort of stick a person of color into a position so that you can say you had a person of color there, but they have no role outside of the stereotypes that their gender, that their race entails. So for example, in movies, if there's like a bunch of white people, they'll put a black guy in, and the black guy is good at sports and good at dancing and that kind of stuff. And that's really his whole character. His whole character is based on these racial tropes and not based on a personality. He's not seen as a person. He's just seen as black guy, right? So it becomes this, like, you the character are what white people have decided that black people are, like a good athlete and a good singer and a good dancer, and that's like what you are. There is no, you're not a person of depth with a real personality. You're just an amalgamation of traits that people have associated with you, and they stick you in there for that. There's also tokenization in, like, you have a commission. For example, Governor Sununu just started a commission on police brutality, and there's one organization on there that's a people of color organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. President is allowed from that chapter. But besides that, there's nobody else that's a person of color at that table, and there's, I don't know, 10 other people at that table. It's tokenization to put one person in there and say that you're making meaningful change on behalf of communities of color when the only person of color at the table is one person from one faction, one organization.
Gotcha. So can you tell us how we can help? Like, what is it that we could do starting today and make baby steps going forward that can help?
Yeah. So it depends on where you are, I think, in the process of learning. So I guess there's different actions that you can take And, you know, you should continue on your path. And that's sort of, I think, the most important piece. So I know that there has been, this is one of those tricky things, because I frequently am posting about how people need to actually do something and you can't just read and listen. But reading and listening is the first step. Reading and listening and understanding and educating yourself is the beginning. So if you have known nothing about this, you should learn about it. The second thing that you should, and you should sort of wrap yourself in this. In other words, you should be consumed by it and let yourself feel that feeling, because that is what it, like, Black folks have to be consumed and deal with race every day, all the time. And we don't. Right. So you have to understand that, you know, you can take a break from reading, but Black folks, this is their whole life. They have to do this all the time. So I think the important thing to do is to start by reading. And I've given some books that I've read that's on the reading list. There's some, there is even a book on that list by a white guy. I don't normally cite white guys in reading lists, but this guy's name is Tim Wise, and he wrote a book called White Like Me. And that's a good starting place for some people. If you're not ready to hear the realities of being Black, it's good to maybe start. Maybe you need something that's it's easier to ease into, and Tim might be a good place to start. I understand people's feelings get caught up in these moments. The most important thing that you can do is not take these things personally, like we talked about from the beginning. You have to accept that I'm racist too, right? We're all racist because we're part of this system, and we've lived that way forever. Do I try to be anti-racist? Do I make efforts to be anti-racist? Yes, I try to do those things. Sometimes I fail. I'm sure I've made misstatements on this podcast. But the reality is you have to keep trying and not take it personally when you make a mistake. And when somebody says to you, that's a mistake, you have to be able to hear that and incorporate that criticism going forward in your work. So there's other things that you can do. You can support Black businesses. You can seek them out and support them. You can vote. You can make yourself aware of how laws that are being passed by your legislatures could impact communities of color in negative ways. You can do all kinds of things. One of the things, you know, that I'm going to tell you, so as you may or may not have noticed, I don't say criminal justice system. There's nothing just about the criminal system. I think the criminal system was something that was made after slavery to continue to keep Black people down. And that's exactly what the system does. And I think in that way, the criminal system works as it was intended to work, unfortunately. So there are things for me, when people say we need to reform this, we need to reform that, it's like you can't reform something that was never built to work the way that we want it to work. Now, it works the way it was intended to work, and putting small fixes in it is not going to change that. So you want to be careful about, you know, those kinds of things. So talk to people that know about stuff. Learn things and learn about that kind of thing. I posted a bunch of stuff in the notes about the current movement. So talking about defunding the police, abolishing the police, what that means, what that looks like, what that would look like for our world today. And the thing I want to encourage people to do is sort of think beyond their education. So recognize that you've been, you know, this was one of the things that I learned so much from you from yoga training. It was like, when I started taking this, it was like, oh my gosh, there's like this entire way of thinking about things that I've just never been exposed to. This is another aspect of that. This is a way of thinking about things that maybe you haven't been exposed to. So your brain is going to take time to integrate all of this stuff. And honestly, you're never going to stop growing and learning. Just like, you know, Lisa, we talk about this all the time with yoga. It's like you never really stop growing or learning more and more about yoga. This is sort of, you never are going to stop growing and learning more and more about racism and the way it infects and it pervades everything. So you should learn and incorporate those things and, you know, use your power to do the things that can make a difference. So show up, go to vote. Don't call the police on Black people. I don't call the police in general at all. I know people will not follow that rule, but you know, and I understand why there's certain times I have done it for insurance purposes before. So I understand it. You shouldn't call the police about things that are things that can be solved in the community. That's not what the police are there for. And when we call them for all these sorts of problems, they end up involved in things they shouldn't be involved in. And that can harm communities of color.
So I wanted to end with, and I thank you so much for that, because, you know, it just helps me understand that there are terms. We have to understand what they mean, how they are conceptualized in our lives and the world, you know, as one, because the states technically are separate, but it's all land.
Yeah.
So you began yoga because, I mean, for many different reasons, but one of them being that you have a stressful job, right? Yeah. And you were seeing some things that were maybe a little unjust, and you were, it was like a coping, some of the piece of a coping mechanism for you. Can you maybe explain like what your journey was going from, you know, how you started and what you learned maybe and what you got out of it?
So I feel like in a lot of ways, my yoga training, you know, what's interesting to talk about this now, and I didn't think about this till you asked this question, but my yoga initiation started in like sort of a very appropriation-y way on my part, right? So I was like, I'm stressed out. I'm having a hard time. What can I do to help? And people had always said, yoga, yoga, yoga. All my white friends, yoga, yoga, yoga. So I started going to classes and I sort of realized that, okay, this like body movement piece is one aspect of this. And that does make me feel better. And that's frequently something that white people grab onto, is that more the physical piece and the way just essentially they just treat it as like a workout class, right? That is one aspect of yoga for me. But for me, the yoga, started to learn more about yoga, I realized it was like, okay, now I can see both how this physical piece is basically sort of this is just the appropriation piece, right? This just doing this is ignoring the other pieces of yoga. And when I learned about the other aspects, it was like, oh my gosh, like this is a totally different way of looking at things. Yoga is really helpful for me in terms of not seeing things in terms of a binary all the time. Things aren't necessarily good and bad. There's not like good and bad people or good and bad this. It's like things exist on a continuum, and it's like learning to be able to handle change and be able to adjust to change and being comfortable and happy with where you are, no matter what's kind of happening around you. And for me, that's been sort of the biggest aspect. I was internalizing a lot of things at work in a very sort of, in a negative way. It was causing stress on my body and stress on my mind, stress on my family, because it was just sort of like, I felt very frustrated by my inability to help. And then when I took a step back with yoga, it became more like, okay, Cynthia, like this isn't really about you, right? This isn't really about you. You're making this about you, and you're causing yourself the stress by making this about you. You can acknowledge that this is a stressful job and a hard job. And you can also say, but this is, you know, this is from my perspective and my experience, and here are the things I can do to manage that. And here are the things I can do to recognize that, like, my representation of people that don't have the ability to, you know, can't afford paid attorneys is a privilege in and of itself. My ability to do that is a privilege in and of itself. Like, people they don't have the money to be able to take sort of a job that's not as high paying as some law jobs and not as fancy as some law jobs, quote unquote, and to be able to represent these folks. And I sort of just recognized that I was putting myself too central into these sorts of my representation of people, and that it wasn't about me. And it became more, I feel more connected in general with the world after yoga training. I feel more able to go with the flow. And I know that sounds trite, but it isn't. That's a means of survival. And I feel like, interestingly, to bring it back to this racism discussion, that's something that people of color have had to do forever is they have to exist and survive in a world where they're under attack or oppressed constantly. And I think for me that yoga was sort of understanding that and learning about that, and then sort of like understanding that I am not that person and that I have a lot of gifts and that I have been given a lot of blessings, and that I can sort of celebrate those and ride the waves of change in a way that that allow me to continue to speak out, but still allow me to remain like to not lose sight of my mental health, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day to do this, to help educate me over this past year and a half. And then hopefully this will educate some other people that, you know, may just be wondering like, what is going on? And why don't I understand it better? Or maybe they understand it great. But I just wanted to make sure that we got out some of the information that you've been studying and learning over the past 10 years or so to help us so we can be good allies.
So you should look into all this stuff yourself. But if this gives you a jumping off point, then I hope that it's a jumping off point that puts you on solid ground.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Thank you.
If you made it to the end of this episode, thank you. This was very difficult for us to put together, knowing that it may be a trigger for some. I definitely feel like I am just in gratitude for everything in my life and need to do better to really raise voices for those that don't have them. And so we felt we can help in this way by coming together to share the knowledge that we do know, or at least what I have learned. So thank you. Really, thank you. If you wanted to know what Ohana is up to, between now and July 1st, we have an online membership that is available. It's on the website, ohanayoganh.com. And it's available for people who are really wanting to continue to stay home through this COVID crisis and really want to spend the summer at home with their families, or just are really feeling like time is valuable and they want to be able to take classes when they can. So you have now this opportunity of almost 100 classes where you could take one every day or take one whenever you want. So that's what we have going on currently. So if you want more information, please don't hesitate to reach out. In the meantime, I love you all so very much and really am just trying to do my best for all of you and anyone else that I can touch. Bye.